session number 9483, Reel 3.
Mr. Templar, Reel 3.
Yes, I will be on duty for 24 hours from the Saturday, 6 o'clock on the Saturday evening. And as Mr. and Mrs. Pardeter and Daisy and her sister Prim, who was younger, were coming down to the camp on the Sunday to see John and I was going to be on duty and I should not see them. So I had a little talk with the corporal of the guard I'd relieved, and for a consideration he agreed to hover about on the Sunday wearing his equipment so that he could grab my rifle if my visitors arrived and there was nobody about, so that he could take over my job for me for a short time while I spent some time with John's parents and Prim, and particularly Daisy. She was christened Margaret Louise, but they always called her Daisy. But she was the lady of my dream. And we had a very pleasant while together, and then I had to return to duty. I left my rifle with the deputy corporal, spent some time with her and the others, and then dashed back when I thought it was advisable to do so. Grabbed my rifle from the corporal, and he said goodbye and soldiers farewell, and that was that. And the extraordinary part about it was that the story never got out, because the deputy corporal didn't want anybody to know anyway, and the men thought it was all a huge bloody joke for me to disappear from guard, and they treated it such, and they kept their mouths shut.
When did you first become aware that you were going to be posted overseas?
When, just before Christmas, 1915, all leave was stopped, and I realised then that it was possible that we were being prepared for embarkation.
Was an official announcement made?
No, except nothing was said except that all leave was stopped. So John and I, as it didn't worry the majority of the battalion, we came from the north and the west country and all that, but John and I were the two Londoners who wanted to get home. So John and I had a talk together. We went into Whitley, saw the cycle repairer there, and said, can we hire a couple of bikes? And he said, yes. We wanted to go into Guildford or somewhere like that. And he said, that'll be all right. So on Christmas Eve, when more or less the Christmas holiday started, we vanished from camp after breakfast and went to the cycle people to get cycles to cycle to Guildford, because we didn't feel that we could jump on a train at Whitley and depart with the leave stopped. So having arranged with the corporal in charge of our hut, who was a senior to me, I had a talk with him, and he agreed to see that our blankets were put down and our bed taken up in the morning, so that it would appear that we were still there. So we disappeared, went to the cyclist place, and the cycle repairer said, oh, I'm sorry, you can't have them, they're out of condition. He said they won't jobs doing on them. I think he was lying, really. He'd heard the news. So John and I walked away from there, a little bit flabbergasted, and suddenly a motor car came along the lane from the south of us, and when he saw us walking along the road, he stopped. He said, hey boys, do you want to go anywhere? We said, yes. Where do you want to go? We said, Guildford or Godalming. He said, well, I'm going to Guildford, hop in. So we hopped in and said, thank you very much. He dropped us at Guildford station. I popped into the ticket office. John kept a lookout on the outside. We found there were no military police on duty, and there should have been. So I went in and bought tickets, because we had no leave passes. John popped in when he said there was nothing about, and the train had just come in, London train just arrived at the platform, so we passed the ticket collector, popped into a garage, into a carriage that was empty, and got down low, so we weren't seen through a window. And as the train pulled out, I remember peeping over the top of the window ledge, and I saw a military policeman, a red cap, just coming on, putting his military duty badge on, MP, and we were away. We got to London, nobody took any bloody notice of us, and we both went to our respective homes and spent a couple of days with my parents, and he with John with his family, and I think we had one little meeting in between, and then we left on Boxing Day to catch a train back to Whitley, and it would arrive after lights out. So we got to Whitley station, and instead of getting out onto the platform, we opened the offside door onto the line, and we both dropped down onto the railway line, crossed the up line into the woods, and that was where we went through the woods back to our camp and got there. So we got to our hut. I opened the door, turned the handle of the hut door, and a voice said, "Is that you, Charlie?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "For Christ's sake, get into your blankets quick, don't undress." So we both crawled in. I said, "Thanks, chum." We both crawled in and got to our blankets and rolled up and went to sleep. And then the next couple of days we were going down to Southampton to get on the La Marguerite, which was Marguerite, another Marguerite, you see.
So your colleagues had covered for you the whole time that you were out of camp?
Yeah. Oh, they do, you know.
So, as a result of leave being cancelled, you guessed that you would be sent abroad. Was there an official announcement made at any time?
No, it was expected that we would be going.
Did you have any prior knowledge of where you were being posted to?
Not really, except that when we were sent up to Yorkshire, we had the impression that we were more or less being put back. Otherwise, we might have finished up in the Dardanelles. Being put back like that meant that we eventually returned to Whitley, or Aldershot, the south, and to finish our training in conjunction with the division to which we were then appointed, you see.
What was your reaction to finally being posted abroad?
Well, I was just over 21 then, and like all other young men in the battalion, we were a little bit excited at the thought of going overseas. No other thoughts, virtually. We didn't want to be killed, that's certain, but the fact of going down, we were going down to Southampton and going on board the La Marguerite, which was an old paddle steamer that had plied in the channel. And Marguerite was the name of which my lady love was christened.
Were there any special preparations made for your posting to France? Were you issued with any special kit for it?
No, we were already equipped.
Were you given any lectures or advice on the way you should behave in France?
No, we were already disciplined.
And we've already established that you had no...
The point was that we were a unit, we were a battalion. And as a battalion, you behaved yourself according to the way in which you've been trained. And we'd expected to go abroad. That was what we enlisted for. And it was a matter of, initially, I suppose, a bit of excitement at the thought of going on to active service.
Was there a strong sense of regimental pride?
Oh, yes. People were definitely... This is what I already told you about the fact that we marched everywhere. All right, we marched everywhere and we sang everywhere. And singing on the march is one of the most marvellous things for creating a sense of unity in a battalion, especially a battalion as recently formed as we were, about 12 months before, you see. And I think it was contributed largely to the efficiency of the battalion. You acted as a unit.
So, we're on the Marguerite in the first few days of January in 1916, yeah. And you're on your way to France. What can you remember about the journey?
Except that the sea was very rough and very choppy, and most of the battalion was seasick. I was one who didn't suffer, and so was John. We'd been on the sea before. But the point was that there were people being sick all around us, and it was rather unpleasant. The only other one that I was with who was not seasick that I recollect was the regimental sergeant major. As we were signals, and I was an NCO, I was in with his group. And he just spat in the cuspidor and talked about the jungle.
How long did the voyage take?
Well, I forget, we were tossing about in Southampton water for a long time. But we landed on this particular day about daybreak, just about dawn, or just before dawn.
So you went across at night?
Yes. And landed at Havre. The jetty then was just a stone pier out into the Atlantic. And La Marguerite docked alongside this jetty, and we were paraded on the jetty, and we helped unload all the various limbers and things that were deck cargo. The night had been very, very cold. All the ropes and that were frozen solid. And to get them undone, to untie them so that you could get them onto the quay, the knots of the ropes had to be hit with our entrenching tool helves in order to break the ice on them, you see, to get them undone. And then, as we had our own band, which was a brass band, the colonel ordered the band to go to the head of the column to play us off the jetty. But the amusing thing was that their instruments were all cold and, you know, nearly frozen, and they tried to blow them and get some sort of tune, but it was an extraordinary noise. The only thing that worked all right were the drums, and they beat. So we marched off to an extraordinary sound of the band trying to play, but the drum gave us the marching time. Before we were moved off the jetty, John had been told to take charge of the colonel's horse and lead it, follow the battalion leading the horse, so that when we got to the camp he could hand it over to the orderly who was in charge of it, for the colonel. Unfortunately, John had little to do with horses and was rather nervous. And the horse took charge of John and went for a look round Havre. Eventually, they turned up and I was very relieved. But there was nobody had noticed it. They did turn up eventually, the horse still hanging onto John, rather than John hanging onto the horse. And they got back and everybody was all right then. And we stayed, they were bell tents, there was about 6 inches of snow on the ground.
Was the camp actually just outside Le Havre?
Just outside the harbour. And we went into these bell tents, rather cold and uncomfortable, and we thought, well, we're going to have to be prepared for these sort of things. So we got a bucket of water each and washed ourselves out, chest down to the sofa, as we could. It was rather an experience, but we had a towel down afterwards and that was all right. A few days afterwards we were moved off to a railhead which consisted of goods trucks. And on the side of the wagons there was a notice which said 10 horses or 40 men. So 40 men got into each of these because they were also the only provision for 10 horses. We didn't have any horses. And we were in the train for, I think, a couple of days or more, and finished up in a place called Levante, which was not far from Béthune on one side and La Bassée.
What were your first impressions on getting to France?
Oh, it all seemed very strange. As we marched through towns, there were all sorts of peculiar advertisements which tickled the men very much, including me. There were large advertisements on the front of business houses where there were shops and that sort of thing. And the one of them that tickled everybody was the one which said, "Bon for the bust," "Bon pour la bust," which meant, you know, the ladies' outlines. And the men said, "We'd never see anything like that in England, did we?" And laughed their heads off. However, we got to Levante, and there had been, we were billeted in little houses, but knocked about by some small shells, which we call whiz-bangs.
How far from the front lines were the houses? Were you billeted?
Oh, I don't know, a couple of miles probably or less. I really don't know. We were all very, it was all very strange. And Jerry was inclined to use these whiz-bangs, and occasionally in that time, in 1916, they used gas shells. And one evening, there was a gas alarm, because sentries on duty in that area had empty shell cases hanging on sort of gibbet, which if they smelt gas, they used to hit with their entrenching tools and make a noise, and people would put their gas masks on, you see, which we did on one occasion, and it turned out to be a false alarm.
Was this when you were in your billets, or was this actually in the
We were not exactly billets, they were empty houses, and we just rolled up in blankets in them.
So there was an expectation that gas attacks would occur that far behind the lines?
Oh yes, there was at that time.
What sort of preparations had been made, and what sort of kit had been issued to help you cope with gas attack?
Well, we were issued in France with a gas helmet, which was made of a sort of flannelette. It had goggles, which you could look through, and a non-return valve mouthpiece. The whole helmet went over the head, and you opened your tunic, tucked the ends under the tunic, and buttoned your tunic up. We had a gas alarm on one occasion. Do you want that? We had a gas alarm on one occasion, and the shell cases were banged, and we all put our gas helmets on over our heads and under our tunic collars, and we were paraded by the sergeant major, and he also was wearing his gas mask, but everybody was very amused because he hadn't noticed that the glass goggles in his helmet were missing. And he had, therefore, if it had been a real gas attack, he'd probably have been bought it, you see. However, it was a false alarm and we were all stood down.
Did the equipment foster confidence? Did you feel it would be effective in the event of a gas attack?
Well, at that point, it was our first experience of gas masks, and we assumed that they would be effective for us. They were made with a flannelette, and it felt as though they'd been treated with something like a glycerine or a glycerine mixture, which would act as a filter and probably a neutralizer. I didn't know, but it never occurred to us. So we put them on and had a certain amount of confidence that we were all right.
Could you tell me a bit about your accommodation and your daily living routine?
It's a long time ago. It was 70 years ago, in fact. And I'm afraid I'm a little bit vague. We lived. We rolled up wherever it was dry and reasonable and went to sleep. Our rations were available because we had few kitchens there to supply us with our meals. And it was a question of waiting when time before we went into more active service.
Was there any
At that time, however, we had a field telephone service which were run to our companies, and the signals were looking after that. But if we were in an area or wanted a message to go to somebody else just outside our telephone range, The signaller's job was to take it on bicycles in the dark. When we were moving about, you couldn't have a, in the dark, you couldn't have a cycle light on, because, you know, even a little light is a bit of a danger sometimes, so you rode on. On one occasion, I had to take a message to a place about a couple of miles away. And I was riding, it was wet, and the roads were icy and very slippery, and I ran onto a lot of cobbled stones, which they used in all the villages there. And they were dangerous when they got ice on them, because your cycle wheels had nothing to grip. And I was riding into this place to get to the point where I was supposed to deliver a message, when I was suddenly yelled at to halt, who goes there? And my bike slid from under me, and I just dropped onto my feet, fortunately, and then found the point of a bayonet sticking right up under my nose. So I swore at the sentry, and he said, advance, friend, and be recognised. And everything was all right then.
So can you tell us a bit more about the telephone system?
Well, we had twin cables for that sort of thing. Cables which had two wires, and they were opened up and connected onto the little field telephones.
And who would be linked with who on the telephone system?
Well, from battalion headquarters to the available companies that were nearby. But when we got in other areas, we were issued with a heavier wire which had a copper core and a single line in any case, so that we, although we ran two lines out, we ran out pairs of them, they were a much better line and less liable to be broken. That was later, though.
So how many lines would there tend to be coming from battalion headquarters?
Well, we had to have a line to division, for one, or from division. And then we had our own four companies. And usually there was a telephone link between the companies, because some of the signal section were stationed with the companies. They came from A, B, C, D company, four companies. It's so long ago now that I'm a little bit hazy. But what do you expect from a poor old...
I'm interested in this from the point of view of who was able to talk to who in the battalion, and who was the battalion able to talk to in terms of getting onto division?
Well, as we were divisional troops, we were in direct contact with division. We had a call sign, which was GLM. In other words, GL for Gloucesters, and M was the 13th letter in the alphabet, therefore we were the 13th Gloucesters. And as such, we were linked with the division and, at times, with the three brigades to which we were attached. So that our functions were, as signallers, were to keep communication both division with our companies, and then it was up to division to communicate with their brigades, you see.
In terms of the battalion communications, clearly battalion headquarters could talk to the four companies.
Well, it depends where they were. If they had to send up working parties into the line or into support of the troops up there, very often we had to send runners on bicycles to get as near as they could to them and then leave their bicycles and go on foot to find the company commander or the man you were sent with a message for. To a certain extent, signallers were fortunate because when there was any action up front, they were on communications for the battalion, you see, and therefore the times they were going into the front line was one to take messages and bring replies back and report to the colonel. That was how it was arranged.
Now, presumably you didn't spend all your time in the trenches, but you were up and down amongst the trenches.
We were mostly toward the communication entrances of the trenches. We were either in the rear zone of the trenches in a dugout, or we were just outside. That's with the battalion headquarters, but when it was necessary, the battalion headquarters went into the line, you see, and we had dugouts there, which we work from.
Can you describe the dugouts to me?
Well, they were varied according to the ground. If you remember that in northern France, of course, up just north of Ypres, there were virtual marshes out in front there, in front of Passchendaele and all around the Messines area. And the fact that front line, whenever we went up to the front line in just north of Ypres, the trenches were mostly inches deep in water.
What about the trenches around Levante?
I didn't go into the trenches there. We weren't there very long. It was just a matter of a little bit of acclimatisation for the troops to France, you see.
So you spent a week or two in Levante, really acclimatising to what conditions were like in France.
Yeah.
Where did you go to after then?
We were paraded and we marched to Poppering. I forget how far it was from Levante, but we arrived in Poppering at the railway station there, on which we were embarked on the train, which took us into Ypres, which was 7 miles to the east of Poppering in Belgium, the Belgian area.
How long did the journey take?
Oh, we were travelling by in the dark, you see. Probably didn't take very long, probably an hour. But we were detrained in Ypres itself, at the station. There was a station there. And the battalion occupied the rest of the town. It was in a very devastated condition. In fact, there were a lot of dugouts in the walls of Ypres because it was a walled city, and we, as the battalion signallers, took over the signal dugout, which was near the little gate, and the rest of the battalion were in either very very protected Nissen huts in parts of the buildings there. The shelling had knocked the walls about and there were just huts there which were partly protected by the fallen bricks and that sort of thing. And there were dugouts in most of the wall area.
How far from the German lines were you there?
I'm just guessing now, probably a couple or 3 miles.
Could you tell me about the battalion's duties at this time?
Well, we were, as I explained, we were divisional troops. When I enlisted, I thought that I was enlisting into an ordinary infantry battalion. But because the battalion was recruited from miners from South Wales, from the Forest of Dean particularly, and from a lot of miners from the North Country, we were a pioneer battalion. And as a pioneer battalion, we supplied working parties up in the front line wherever they were needed for repairing trenches or parapets or doing any building digging work. And we were also available to give support to either brigades who were in the line at the same time and wanted backup support from our own battalion, you see. And therefore we were always in sort of battalion headquarters area with there, but the companies supplied the working parties up in the front line. That was our job. And it was something that I hadn't anticipated, really. I expected to be in more action than I was.
So you were surprised at the role that the battalion was undertaking when you got to France?
Yes. Because I had joined them and thinking they were an ordinary infantry battalion, but instead of that, I discovered that they had been recruited from